You're listening to episode 85 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey, what's up, Storyteller Tribe? Before we get started, I wanted to thank Sunbasket for sponsoring today's episode. I'm so proud to collaborate with a meal kit delivery service that focuses on offering organic, healthy, and delicious recipes and ingredients straight to your door. Check out sunbasket.com/88cups to check out the special offer they have for our Storyteller Tribe. And hang around at the end of the show to find out more about Sunbasket. Please remember that whenever you support Sunbasket during our collaboration with them, that indirectly supports our show. Thank you so much in advance for trying out their 88 Cups of Tea offer. And if you signed up for their newsletter through our link, a big thank you to you too. I also wanted to take a moment to thank all of you for being so incredibly supportive of our show. I appreciate each and every one of you for joining us on a weekly basis. And if you just found our show, thank you for making your way through our archive of episodes. For anyone who's just hearing about our archive for the first time, just head over to 88cupsoftea.com/archive to find all of the guests we've had on our show. A massive hug for our amazing listeners who've recommended and shared our podcast with friends and left incredibly touching iTunes reviews. On to the next part of our show. Have you joined our private Facebook group yet? It's the perfect place for you to be if you're looking for a loving community to hang out with fellow storytellers and to check in with each other about your work in progress. Our group is filled with support and encouragement, and we also post threads where you can submit your listener questions for upcoming interviews with really cool guests. We just recently started recording live Facebook videos that's exclusive only for our members in the private group. And we're talking about book hauls and unboxing videos. And sometimes I'll even record live videos where I'll chat with members in our group while I prepare dinner. So be sure to come over and hang out with us at facebook.com/group/88cupsoftea. You'll feel right at home and I'm so excited to meet you in there. That's facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. One more thing before we introduce today's amazing guest. This week, we have four listener birthday shoutouts. First and foremost, a very happy 21st birthday to my little sister, Lilina Chang, and a very happy birthday to the amazing Alyssa Coleman, Sarah Ellen, and Kim Martin. I hope you ladies have the best time celebrating your special day, and may all your dreams and wishes come true. Now on to our show. I'm so excited to share this week's new episode featuring the legendary Jerry Spinelli of the Newbery Medal-winning Maniac McGee and the Newbery Honor winner, Ringer. He's the New York Times bestselling author of over 30 novels, including Stargirl, a Publisher's Weekly Best Book of the Year, and also a book that's being adapted into a movie directed by Catherine Hardwicke from the films 13 and Twilight. In describing Jerry's writing, the New York Times says, "No writer guides his young characters and his readers past these pitfalls and challenges towards their futures with more compassion." In Jerry's episode, we jump right into his childhood stories that paved the way to his journey as an author, and we touch back on the experience that led Jerry to realizing he could make a career out of writing. We dive a little deeper to discuss how he created a writing life that involved a full-time job and raising a family, and how you can too. Further into Jerry's episode, he brings us behind the scenes in writing Maniac McGee. He also shares the inspiration behind his newest book, The Warden's Daughter, and the important differences between writing for the audience and writing about the audience. Jerry shares his take on writing honest stories for your readers and how to craft authentic voices for your characters. He also walks us through his loose writing structure and shares tips on financially supporting yourself as a writer that works with your lifestyle. If you've been feeling stuck with your writing lately, look out for the part where Jerry explains what the miserable middle is and his advice on coping with those moments and why it's crucial to not give authority to writer's block. For listeners who are about to send off query letters to literary agents, you'll want to pay special attention to Jerry's querying tips and why writing short query letters will help to show that you're an effective writer. I am so excited for you to hear his episode. Now let's jump right in.
Hey everyone, what an honor it is to have Jerry Spinelli on our show. Jerry, how are you?
I'm good, thank you, and it's my pleasure.
I am so happy to have you with us. I would love to kick it off and ask you, how did you first fall in love with writing and why do you have the need to want to write?
Yeah. Boy, you'd think I would get that question a lot, but actually I don't. So you get early points for that. Oh, I guess that would go back to sixth grade. We had a project, as sixth grade kids do, and it was on Mexico, and everybody was supposed to do a scrapbook about Mexico. And so I did, like everybody else, cut pictures out of National Geographic and so forth and pasted them in the blank pages of my scrapbook. And here's where I don't have a specific answer to your question, where did it come from? All I can tell you is that for whatever reason, I decided to do something that apparently nobody else did. To the back page of my scrapbook, I added a poem. I wrote it out longhand on that lined paper you get in sixth grade. It was about Mexico. Pasted it carefully onto the back page and turned in my scrapbook along with everybody else. Right then, writer's life got interesting. A couple days later, my mother was called into school to face the teacher and the principal, who apparently they did not believe that I wrote the poem myself. I was charged with plagiarism. I was not in on the meeting, but my mother went in, and I don't recall everything she said about it, but I do recall the outcome, which was that by the time she walked out of the school that day, I was exonerated. Apparently, she was a good salesman and convinced them that, in fact, I did write them, and I would not commit such a dastardly crime. And that was that. I think of that as my first foray into writing, and I don't know if it really affected me. When I give my talks, I say, well, I was declared innocent, but I didn't feel that way. I still felt accused and abused, and maybe that's why for the next, what would it be, 5 years or so, I didn't write another thing until I was a junior in high school, and there was a football game and a particularly dramatic goal line stand whereby our team held off one of the best teams in the country, and we won the game, and Norristown went crazy, and I went home while everybody else was kicking cans, yelling, screaming, blaring horns, and I wrote a poem, my second poem. In this case, about that dramatic goal line stand. Again, wrote it out longhand, this time on paper with no lines, and wrote it out, showed it to my father, handed it to him, forgot about it. A couple days later, I opened the local newspaper, as I always did, to the Times Herald and to the sports page, and there in the middle of the sports page is my poem in a box. I had not realized what happened after I gave my father the poem, that he, the next day, took it down to the paper. He was friends with a sports editor, showed it to the sports editor. Apparently, he liked it enough to publish it in the paper. So overnight, I was famous in my high school. Everybody pat me on the back, you know, way to go, man. And I think, you know, in this case, my writing didn't get me accused of a crime. It got me congratulated and patted on the back. And I'm thinking, this is cool. Maybe at that point, I started to think maybe I should look at this writing thing. When I think about the beginnings, I think of those two poems.
I love that. You know, this also makes me wonder, your dad is so encouraging. Not many writers had that kind of encouragement growing up from parents. A lot of them had to butt heads a lot with their parents about writing. What was your dad's background? Was he a writer himself? Did he love to read?
He did love to read, but no, he was not a writer at all, at least not in the way that we think of the term writer. But he was, interestingly enough, an associated career. He was a printer. He was a dinosaur. He was somebody who, for the most part, doesn't exist anymore. He was the guy who took little lead letters out of a box and put them into a print form. One letter, one period, one punctuation at a time. And that's how he would set up a page of whatever it was that had to be printed. He was called a compositor. That's pretty much gone the way of the dinosaur these days. Now printing is done with chemicals and electronic and photography and so forth. But in those days, it was somebody like my father, a compositor, picking out each little item that appeared on the page one by one and locking them into a form. That's what he did. I guess he always had an appreciation of the printed word, although he was not by any means a writer in his own right. He was the only member of his family, in fact, who finished high school. He did have that extension. And as I sit here at my desk, well over a half a century later, I'm looking at a gold cross ballpoint pen that he gave me many years ago, and just always really touched me that he would do that. He really didn't understand much about what I did, but he understood, I think, that it was something pretty cool, and that was his way of making a connection with what I did, was to give me the gold pen, and it has been on my desk ever since.
Man, I have the biggest smile on my face. He sounded like an incredible dad that anyone would be lucky enough to have. Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for sharing that story with us, Jerry. I love sharing these stories with our listeners, for the community, because it all makes us connect as humans and reminds us of our own relationships with our own parents and what we want to do as parents to pass on to our kids, too, to inspire them and encourage them, right?
Sure.
So thank you for that. I know that you mentioned versus the first time where they didn't believe that you wrote, you did your report because it was so brilliant up to the time that you wrote that poem. Were you reading books or did you stay away from them because you might have still been traumatized by that experience? What was that like for you during that time? Do you have solace in books?
I think I do now, but at that time, no, I did not. I think probably a lot of writers would tell you that they were writing stories or performing skits in the backyard for their neighbors and reading Little Women when they were six and all that. I did not. When I was growing up, until about the time I was, say, 15 or 16, I was mostly an athlete. I mean, I was a good student. And I certainly could read, and when I did read, I enjoyed it, but I very seldom did read. If I had an hour to occupy, it never occurred to me to read a book. It occurred to me to play a game. So I was mostly into sports. My seasons were not summer, spring, winter, fall. They were football, basketball, baseball. In particular, my dream was to be a Major League Baseball player, and that held my attention until about the time in high school when I wrote that poem, as a matter of fact, about the football game. But until then, I was pretty serious about sports in general and baseball in particular, and spent very little time reading. There's a character in one of my books, Maniac McGee, who carries a book with him everywhere he goes. In retrospect, I don't think I did it consciously as I was writing the book, but in retrospect, I suspect that I put a book in that 12-year-old kid's hand to, it's the closest I could come to going back and doing it right myself. I do regret that I didn't read more when I was a kid, but that's a fact. I really didn't begin to read on my own other than classroom assignment until much later.
That's so fascinating. So when did you realize that being a writer is a possible career? Was it that moment when your poem about the football game was published? Was that when you realized, hey, this could be a thing? This could be my career. This is my dream now. Was that the very moment that it happened?
I don't know if it was the very moment, but it certainly was the very year. It was around that time, definitely, because I know that because I know that by the time I graduated from high school, I was one of the few classmates who actually knew what they wanted to do. A lot of kids were going off to college or wherever, the armed forces, not knowing what they wanted to make of their lives. By the time I graduated from high school, yes, I knew I wanted to be a writer. Nobody told me how to go about it. Didn't have any mentors. I didn't know what to expect. But I went off to Gettysburg College knowing that I wanted to be a writer, even if I didn't know how.
Talk about being a self-starter. On the way to being a writer, did you balance full-time jobs while writing on the side, or did you just throw yourself in there?
I would have been happy to throw myself in there if there was a thing as, say, a fiction factory that I might have applied for work when I got out of college. But unfortunately, there was no such thing. As most writers find out, you kind of have to invent your own life. I wrote my books on my spare time, as one writer said, in the cracks, after dinner, on weekends, closing my office door on lunch hours, did my writing in the cracks of time that were provided to me. Otherwise, yes, I had a job because there were potatoes had to be put on the table. I did both things.
Oh, man. Okay, so now you having a family, was your significant other fully supportive right away? Did she know about your dream about also writing? Was she fully on board with that? First of all, Jerry, we have a lot of listeners in our community for our podcast. Many of them have families. Many of them are parents who do very much like you. They're gazing in time between the cracks to write what it is they want to write. And I do believe it makes such a huge difference when you have so much love and encouragement from your spouse, from your significant other, and your children too. If they believe in you and your writing, it makes the world of a difference with your writing and also your motivation to want to get the words down. So for you, was that something that was natural for you where everyone was on board in your family where they're like, okay, yes, we know that you've got to get this done. Let's do everything we can to help you out and I'll take care of this. Mom will take care of that. And then dad, you go quickly go to your office and work on your writing right now. Was it anything like that? Or was it more so really trying to squeeze and almost sneak in time to do your writing?
I'm happy to say that that was never a problem for me. In fact, the problematic aspect of it was so absent, I almost feel guilty because it was so easy. My wife is Eileen Spinelli, who is an author in her own right. She's, in fact, I like to think that we may be, if not one of the only, perhaps even the only husband-wife team who have had books on the New York Times bestseller list at the same time. If any other couple can make that claim, I'll be happy to join them. In any case, yes, my wife Eileen is a writer as well. When I mentioned that many writers seem to have gotten such an early start, they were reading Little Women at the age of 6. Well, actually, when I said that I had my wife in mind, Eileen was reading Little Women at the age of 6, and she found her way into print before I did. She had poems published in Saturday Evening Post, which was the leading periodical of its day. Getting spousal support was never a problem for me.
Wow, I love that. I had no idea that you both were on the New York Times bestseller list at the same time.
Oh, I don't
That's
think
incredible.
Most people don't know that, yeah.
This is the first time I'm ever hearing anything like this, and that is a cool fact. I am proud to have that on this show. So thank you for that cool tidbit.
Right, you heard it here first.
Cool. Thank you for giving me more street cred. I love it. And I love that you're saying that you feel so lucky, you almost feel guilty.
Yeah.
Wow, Eileen needs to listen in on this episode, and she's going to be so touched to hear all the kind words that you were saying about her. That's beautiful. I'm lucky to be in a relationship with someone who does understand my passion and my arts and really makes time for me to do all of that. So I am very lucky, and I hope it continues that way so it ends up like you and Eileen too. Like, that's very admirable. And
makes a big difference.
It does. It really does. And Jerry, I know that with writing, it can be a very lonely road and a very lonely path. Now understanding that you had Eileen by your side, did it ever get lonely for you, or did you always feel you had someone who understood you? Because Eileen's also an author.
Personally, no. Because of her constant presence and support.
Oh, I love that.
Writing-wise, professionally, yes, of course. Because I spent, when I graduated from college and took a shot at my first novel, and for the better part of the next 15 years, I wrote 4 novels that nobody wanted. So yes, when your only company is hundreds upon hundreds of rejection slips, they are not warm and fuzzy, and you're going to feel lonely in that sense. No question. As far as our arrangements, that's never been a big problem. We had, when it was necessary, space was not available. My office was my lap, sitting up against the headboard of the bed. And Eileen's would not be much more fancy than that. As time passed, we always made sure that we bought a house with at least 3 bedrooms when, in fact, some of the kids were gone, so that 2 of those bedrooms could become our offices. And now we live on a lake now, and we have our own offices looking out over the water. Yeah, we've always, one way or another, made adjustments and accommodations, at least a little pencil space to do our stories.
Oh, you both are so inspiring. Oh, my gosh. Seriously, Jerry, get out of here. That is amazing. Just imagine you both sitting in your offices overlooking a lake. That is a dream. Congratulations.
Oh, tell me about it. This morning I saw the nearby nesting eagle fly by a couple of days ago. I was looking out, and there, right floating past my window, was a white swan.
yeah. Are you kidding me?
I know.
You know what I see here? I see wild Canadian geese. Yeah. And you get beautiful swans. Thanks, Jerry.
Well, we get our share of geese, too. We have a flock of them camping out on the lake as well.
I do wish we had, you know, one or two swans just floating by over here, but I don't see any of those. I'm currently staying in San Diego right now between New York and San Diego and in Los Angeles. And when I'm in San Diego, in the back patio, there's a huge golf course, and I see these random egrets, these little white-looking birds. They're staring and looking right at me when I'm on the phone outside chatting on the patio or reading a book. So that's the closest thing I have to a swan. I would love to bring this back to your writing. Tell me one thing that's really exciting you in your work right now that you love us to know about.
The most recent book is called The Warden's Daughter. And that came out in 2 months ago in January. That's the latest that is out. I just finished a picture book called My 4th of July. Just sent it off to my editor. So I haven't even heard back from her on that. That's how recent that is. So, in other words, I'm kind of between books at the moment, and I took a few days vacation, and now just this morning, I'm looking at a mattering yellow sheets with writing on them here on my desk, and they are notes that may become eventually the next book. I actually, in going through my old note and so forth, discovered that I have no less than 5 ideas on the burner for the next book, and I'm not sure which one of them is going to separate from the others in a few days and say, write me. At the moment, I've got 5 possibilities that may become the next one.
First of all, huge congratulations on The Warden's Daughter. I'm going to keep my fingers crossed for your picture book. And also, I love that you're letting all of these notes, these 5 different ideas, brew and sit there. So
I'm
keeping my fingers crossed for those guys, too, for one of them to jump out at you and say, hey, write me right now. You're known as the author who does not hold back with his stories. And like Maniac McGee, you explore racism and homelessness. And The Ringer, the main character, he stands up to peer pressure towards violence and exploring his life growing up as an adolescent. And Warden's Daughter, you also don't hold back. The main character is a girl who does not have a mom. She lives in a county prison. And I love stories like this where it just doesn't hold back. You respect the reader. You know, there are many people out there who are worried about, oh, is the audience, the young audience, able to handle this? Are they able to understand this? Are they, you know, this, that? But the thing is, you have to throw these topics at them so that they can eventually learn. And whatever you throw at them, they're capable and smart enough to adapt to right away and understand.
And I
think the most important thing is just to get it through, especially from what I've learned from talking to amazing guests like you, is really about the honesty in the conversations and the dialogue of the characters and the truthfulness of what is happening in the story, rather than trying to coat it and sugarcoat it and create this bubble to protect the readers. And that's what I love about your work, is that you're able to break that bubble and say, hey, I see you, readers. I see you. And I respect you, and I know you understand what I'm saying. And you hand that responsibility to them, where they take it so much more seriously. I really admire you in that way. And I know this is probably a crazy question to even ask, but to even write like that, how are you able to do that?
To my way of thinking, I did it by not doing it. In other words, by disregarding that whole thing as an issue. Writing, people ask me, what grade level do you write for and all? After 30 years, I still am stumped by that question because I don't write for a grade level. In my mind, as I'm sitting down, and you talked about writing, writers adjusting themselves for the audience and dumbing down things. As I like to say, I don't write for kids. I write about kids. I write for, in my mind, I'm writing for everybody. I don't sit down and craft the best sentence that I can, and then say to myself, okay, now how can I dumb this down for kids? I just craft the best sentence that I can and go on to the next sentence. So what you see in print after my name are stories that I wanted to write, and I was guided not by some perception of what the little kiddies can handle. my conversation wasn't with them at all. It was with the story. I like to think that I take my story, my idea, out to lunch, and I start asking it questions and start getting a conversation going. And when my story starts giving me answers back, like, what makes you tick? How do you want me to do you? And when I start getting answers back to that, that's what I listen to. I listen to the story and let the rest take care of itself. I just put the best story that I can out there and hope that the readers will come to it.
Now, when it comes to these stories that you just respect what it is that they're having to say, how do you then come up with these characters? Let's talk specifically about The Warden's Daughter, because it is your newest book out right now, and I would love for listeners to pick up your copy. I loved your book. I loved The Warden's Daughter.
Thank you.
That was fantastic. Listeners, please do grab yourself a copy of The Warden's Daughter. It's really unique, it's different, and it's real, and you're going to love it, and you're going to be moved by it.
It began with a personal meeting. Maybe 15 years or so ago, I was at an event in the park in Norristown, my hometown in Pennsylvania, which actually became the setting for Maniac McGee, and which I call Two Mills. I changed the name from Norristown to Two Mills. And I was there because schools and teachers sometimes bring carloads and busloads and vanloads of students through the park there to retrace the steps of Maniac McGee in that story. This was one such occasion. I think they must have alerted me that it was happening and asked me to be present to say something to the students. So I guess I was there for that. What I do remember is that after that occasion, one of the teachers or accompanying parents came up to me afterward and said, I'm from Norristown too. And she said, in fact, I grew up in prison. And she went on to explain that when she was in her teenage years, her father was warden of the Montgomery County Prison, which to this day still stands on Erie Street in Norristown. It's an abandoned relic. It looks like a medieval castle or a Norman fortress. You half expect a drawbridge to fall down and an armored knight to come clattering forth. It looks totally out of place in the 21st century. So we got a conversation going, and we've had a relationship ever since. And after some years, finally it dawned on me, I can be real slow sometimes. It hit me what she had done that day. She had dumped a story in my lap, and I was too dumb to see it until some years had gone by. There's a tagline, girl grows up in prison. That's a starting point for a story, if there ever was one. That was the case because she and her father, the warden, and her mother, the warden's living quarters at that time, were right there on the same site as the prison, in the same building above the entrance. They had their own apartment there, and that's why she grew up in prison. Her friends in school loved to come over there for pajama parties, because how cool was that to have a pajama party in a prison on the next floor above Murderer's Row? That happened, and finally it got through to me that this was perhaps the beginning, the launch pad for a story. So I went ahead and started making notes. The character, Cammy O'Reilly, in the story came not so much personally and directly from Ellen Adams, the person that I met at the park that day and who's become my friend. It came more from her situation, one aspect of her situation, which is that she lost her mother while she was in the prison there. I believe it happened when she was either in high school or college. Just as I decided I would make racism and homelessness the focus of Maniac McGee, I thought I would zero in on her lack of a mother and see what we could make of that. But I wanted her to be already living in that situation, so I decided to have her mother disappear actually before the story even begins. When Cammy tells her story when she's 12 and 13, her mother, as it turns out, died before the story begins when she was only a baby. Really, that's what drove her character. My perception of her character was that simple fact, the absence of a mother.
And now with that, Cammy's dialogue, how are you able to craft dialogue so well. You're able to get in their mind so succinctly and I guess you could say accurately, right? And it makes the story that much more real. It gives that much more depth. And I always believe most things are centered around the characters, if not all things. You're able to dive into this language of a girl. And this is also, you know, I mentioned this in previous episodes too, where I'm always fascinated by authors who are able to skillfully get into the mind of the opposite gender and really get that voice down. I think that's a difficult thing. Maybe it's because me self-projecting, that's something I struggle with. So, or that's not the easiest thing for me. So I always am in awe when I see whether it's female authors writing in a male's perspective or a male author writing in a female perspective for the character, but writing it with such honesty and just so much truthfulness to it.
I can't think of anything in particular, only the general idea that I have always enjoyed the company of girls and women, and any writer worth his salt, I simply paid attention. That's where writing starts, with paying attention. You see the things, you hear the things that perhaps skip by the hurried glances of most people. And so I was always a listener. I'm more comfortable in any conversation over a restaurant table or whatever with somebody who's gabby, because I'm not. I would rather listen than talk. Just as reading, I suppose, and I'm just thinking of this out loud, as reading, I suppose, gives one a leg up on getting started in writing, then I suppose listening to people talk gives one a start on beginning to reproduce dialogue. Maybe all those years that I had been listening to mothers and girls and so forth, maybe I was collecting and storing away the way they feel, the way they think, the way they speak, not even realizing I was doing that. Yet when I reached out as I began to write my stories for something to put in someone's voice and words to put in someone's mouth, there they were, the memories of all those conversations and all those words that I had listened to for so many decades. To the point where I think a lot of it was unconscious, I've often said that the most fun part to me of writing, more often than not, is writing dialogue. Some things, aspects of writing, don't come so easy. But for me, writing people talking to each other, that's always come naturally. Maybe that's one of my strengths.
That being your strength, that's also a fantastic gift that you blessed with. I do enjoy dialogue as well, but I wish dialogue was more of a strength for me, and I'm sure a lot of writers would agree with me as well. And now, that being your strength, what do you find is your weakness with writing?
What first comes to mind is something that fellow writer Eve Bunting identified, what she referred to as the miserable middles. When you're starting out, everybody's excited to start out. It's a new journey. It's like leaving the harbor at New York City, you know, on a long voyage. Confetti and cheers and waves and all that. But then a couple months later, you're in the middle of the ocean and you look around and there's nothing but gray water. And you wonder if you're ever going to get there, and you wonder if you're going in the right direction, and you're wondering if it all makes sense, and you're wondering if the thing is moving. Is anybody ever really going to want to turn page after page here? It gets a little more difficult to work yourself up and cheer yourself into a frenzy every day to sit down and do the hard work of writing, more so than it was in those first couple of days. And so you've got to find a way to get yourself through the miserable middle. I think as much as anything, that might be one of the more difficult aspects of writing.
Absolutely. There's so many miserable middles, absolutely, and also writer's block, too. It doesn't even have to be in the middle. It could be at the end or the beginning. That a lot of writers I'm hearing are struggling with in our community. Mm-hmm. It's true, just figuring that out and working through that. And for The Warden's Daughter specifically, was there a difficult scene that you remember that really stood out to you? It took a lot longer than you had hoped for to work on or to work through?
Frankly, no. I take a walk every day, and I remember it was during this book, not in any one of the previous 35, but during the writing of this book that I bought myself a little portable cell phone sized recorder, because ideas, thoughts were coming to me on my walk, and it was becoming difficult to remember them all and then quick jot them down when I got home. And so I didn't want to forget them, and so I bought myself a little recorder so I wouldn't forget the things. What I'm saying is that things seem to come. Ideas and the elements of the story, successive episodes, seem to come fairly naturally once I got the thing underway. As you said, a lot of it comes, if not most of it, if not all of it, comes from the characters. Maybe that says that I had such a clear perception of the main character, not to mention the housekeeper, Alota. Perhaps my view of them was so clear that the rest of the story just followed in their wake. In any case, no, I did not have a sense that this was a difficult book to write or that I had to dig hard and deep in order to plow that ground. It seemed to come fairly easily and naturally. I was all the more thankful for that.
I'm sure, right? So now, throughout all of the books that you've written, just talking about these scenes and just difficulties overall and The Warden's Daughter sounding like the smoothest process, was there one book that you remember that you had a bit of struggle with, whether if it was like a certain character not working out the way you wanted it to, or a storyline that you felt you needed to change around or just to straighten out a little bit? Was there that one story in your past that you felt, oh, that was a tough one, and I'm so glad that I struggled with it for a bit and I'm so proud of it now?
Yeah, my surprise you, because it's one of my best known books. When you ask that question, the answer that comes to mind is Maniac McGee. And I say that because it began, as I recall, with an idea. It actually began with a song that I've always loved called Dancing in the Street by Martha and the Vandellas, an old pop song from the late 50s, early 60s. I just love the vision projected by that song, and has always inspired me. Then I had a thought, and the thought was I wanted to write a book about a kid who was a hero to other kids. And in those days, I was writing longhand and then transcribing onto a typewriter. I wrote about 80 pages and read it over and didn't like it and threw it away and started again. Next time, I tried about 100 pages and read it over, didn't like it, threw it away. Obviously, you know, things weren't going right. It was too scattershot. I discovered that this kid was like a little Superman, and he was putting out fires everywhere. It was too scattered. There was no focus to the story. There was no spine. There were a whole lot of spines. It just wasn't holding together. It had no integrity. At that point, I'd had enough of it. I just need to take a vacation from this story. And so I gave myself a break and I turned my back on it. I think something to this effect may be in the Bible. You turn your back on something and that's exactly when it happens. I turned my back on the story and I took a few days off from thinking about it, much less writing about it. I did nothing. I busied myself with other stuff. While I was doing that, out of nowhere, I was visited by the Muse. I believe in the Muse now because I believe it visited me that night in Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, because, as I said, I was not thinking about this book, was not reaching for it at all. And these words came to me. They just came to me, literally out of nowhere. They say Maniac McGee was born in a dump. I wasn't asking for those words. I wasn't seeking them. I wasn't digging for them. They just came literally out of nowhere. That's why I believe it was the Muse. At least I was smart enough to see what was going on here. And so I followed those words into a couple of paragraphs, and my office was on the first floor in a former piano room at that time. I took it upstairs to Eileen, and I said, listen to this. I just wrote a couple paragraphs here of my next book. I hadn't even had a title then, and I read it to her, leading off from that first sentence. They say Maniac McGee was born in a dump, and she said, oh, my God, that's it. So I went back downstairs and just followed those paragraphs wherever they led and wrote up the story. As I say, that was actually my third try at that story, and this time with the help of the Muse and focusing the story more specifically, giving it a spine, finally I had myself a book.
Wow, that is an incredible story, like a behind-the-scenes view about that book.
Yeah.
My goodness, and then again, just touching back on what we were talking about earlier in our conversation, is about the support you have around you and having a very incredibly encouraging significant other support system to then go forth. I really, you see, again, Eileen being there for you in this process and giving you that nod and that acknowledgement, not even the word approval, but just saying, yeah, this is it. This is the one. And that, oh, you know what? The faith, that hope and that belief in you and that idea. And it just gave you that extra oomph and ammunition to just go forward and charge. It just shows, again, with your storytelling process, difficulties going up and down with this specific book and this specific process of it, the making of it. And look how having that support system there had helped you push through even more. It's a full circle. I love this. This is a beautiful story. Thank you for sharing that. Again, I feel so cool that you shared that with us. That also makes me wonder, just overall throughout your whole career so far with your writing, how do you think you've evolved creatively? You've written so much.
You know what? I don't have any feelings about it. I'll tell you why. Because I can't see myself. I don't have much of a view of how I may or may not have evolved, how my stories may or may not have evolved over the last 3.5 decades or whatever it's been. Because I'm on the inside of it. I'm guessing that people better qualified to answer that are probably the readers. And I'm not one because I don't read my own stuff. I think I reread only one of my books that I can recall. That was Crash, and I don't remember why I did it. Normally speaking, I don't read my own books. I'm done with a story. When I finish it, that's it. I'm ready to get on to the next thing. There's a couple reasons for that in addition to just wanting to move on. I think there are some negative things that can happen if you become a patron of your own stuff. For one thing, and I guarantee it, almost any writer would say this, you start reading your own story, and I guarantee you, before the first page is over, you're going to be kicking yourself in the shins because you're going to see something that you could have done better, a word that could have been changed, a way of saying something. But it's too late now. The book is out there, and there's not a thing you can do about it. That can be frustrating. Reading your own stuff makes you self-conscious. You take the place of the reader. You become the reader instead of the writer. And suddenly you're on the outside looking in. And you're seeing yourself from a different angle. You're outside the window looking in at this person sitting at the desk there, writing under the lamplight, the traditional view of the laboring artist. That makes you self-conscious. The artist, whether it's a painter, sculptor, writer, musician, whatever, you need to be totally within yourself and more than that, within your work. If you're outside yourself and saying, in effect, sitting down and say, well, now here's Jerry Spinelli sitting down at work ready to write his next great book, you're not going to do well. That day's work is not going to be so hot. Why? Because you're self-conscious about it. You're thinking about what you're doing rather than simply doing it. And you can quote me on this, self-consciousness for the artist is poison. For reasons like that, I don't read my own stuff. I try not to think about it too much. And consequently, I don't have much of an opinion as to how my writing may or may not have evolved over the years. So that would be more for the reader to say.
Thank you for that perspective, Jerry. That's interesting because it's the first time we've had an author on the show answer in that way where it's not for the writer to make the judgment. I think that's always refreshing to just have that to shake up what the listeners are hearing and definitely opens up their perspective as well. And just to touch really quickly too, back on what you mentioned right before this, was you mentioned that also because my listeners love talking about the process and the craft of writing, and I do too. You mentioned that you wrote your first several novels longhand, like, and then you transcribed it onto a typewriter. My gosh, how long was that process?
In those days, that was before computers and keyboards and internet and so forth. So from my perspective at that time, that was state of the art. That's simply the way you did things. It would seem and possibly prehistoric now if I had to go back and do things that way. But at that point, that was real time, and that's the way we did things. So I didn't consider myself particularly disadvantaged, just the way everybody from Shakespeare on down did things. That was no particular problem.
Well, Jerry, I'd like to say you could see it as prehistoric, but I feel like we see it as really awesome and really cool and hipster. So you're like one of the OGs in that world. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I went to pick out this typewriter about 2 years ago. And I just thought I was the coolest person in the world with this old school typewriter.
Yeah.
And here I am trying to type up poems with a typewriter. And then, of course, I end up jamming the whole thing. And I'm like, I don't know how you guys were able to do this and fix it. My gosh, you guys had patience. I tried enough wiggling and jiggling around the little space bar and just trying to push it back. I think I broke it even more. Oh, dear.
Yeah.
It was expensive to fix. This is not cheap to carry around a typewriter and have it working properly. It's a bit to, like, make sure it works nicely. Jerry, now we know that you're the cool one who is the person who used a typewriter and everybody wants to be like you, like me. What do you do now?
Actually, Eileen writes hers longhand.
Wow.
And then transcribes on the computer. Me, actually, at one point, early in the days when I had recently gotten a computer and when I was transitioning, I remember at one point I was writing two books at once. I wrote one book longhand in the morning and another book on the keyboard computer at night. So at one point I was doing both, and then I transitioned totally to the keyboard, and that's how I write from first word to last of a given manuscript these days. Cursive still keeps its hand in terms of making notes and so forth. I just got in the old habit because I worked at a publishing company that published magazines, and our copy paper was yellow, and so I've just simply always felt comfortable using yellow paper, so I even buy it now at Staples.
And I love that.
If you see yellow paper on my desk, that's telling you that it's notes that I'm making, and I'll have them spread out around the computer screen and typing in my story.
And also, when you think about it, the color yellow is such a happy, cheery color. So maybe subconsciously, when you're writing down all these notes as well, it just keeps you going and it keeps you happy. It keeps your brain pumping out with those happy energy juices and you just keep writing. You know, you just never know.
Yellow is my favorite color.
Oh my gosh, me too. We could be best friends. I love that. That's awesome. I would love to know again, because we did mention that my community loves to talk about the craft of writing and the analytical side of it. Do you have any sort of a blueprint? Because I know there's a lot of writers who mention that they have these amazing stories in their heads. They keep writing, and similar to writer's block, they'll get stuck. And then they also mentioned they wish they had a blueprint or like a structure where they're just like, okay, this is the middle, this is the beginning, this is the middle, this is the end. But then in the beginning part, they wish that it was broken down almost into a step-by-step guideline of like, well, there's almost like an act one, act two, act three, similar to that of screenplays. What about for you with your writing? Do you have anything of that sort where it keeps you organized so that you don't lose track, or you just let it loose and just write and it takes you wherever it takes you?
Well, I'd say a kind of combination of what you just said. I do not make an outline and blueprint everything to come. It's more just a dumping onto these yellow sheets of paper, a brainstorming kind of thing, which is what I was doing this morning. There's no particular form to it. In fact, it's deliberately formless. I just want everything that's in my head that remotely relates to the story at hand, I just dump it onto the paper, write it into the notes. And at that point, I don't worry about direction, theme, organization, or anything. I'm just dumping everything I can onto the paper. And then as we get along in that, dumping in the original ideas, then it's time to start thinking about a shape of a thing. A famous screenwriter said there's location, location, location for real estate. For screenwriting, it's structure, structure, structure. And I would say that to a large extent, not as much as the movies, applies to fiction as well. I do get in my head a structure, a sense of where I want to start it, and that's easy. To me, cool beginnings are a dime a dozen. It's the rest of it that gets harder. I get an idea of where I want this story to start, and a sense of where I want it to wind up, where I want it to end, where I want to be on the last page. what remains loose and freewheeling is exactly the path that I'm going to take to get from that beginning to that end. As I say, I don't have it outlined. I don't have it mapped out. There's just a general sense in my head, but I keep almost deliberately loose because I want to stay nimble. I want to be able to adjust on the fly. Going back to my sports days, I think of it as a fast break. I'm taking a rebound of the ball, of a missed shot, at one end of the court, off the basket, and I know I want to get 90 feet down to the other end of the court and put the ball in the basket, and so we start a fast break, the five of us players fast breaking from one end of the court to the other. But we don't know exactly, there's no pattern to it, because exactly how we get to the other end and put the ball in the basket is not going to depend on what the opposition throws up to us. So there's no predicting. You have 100 fast breaks, you're going to have 100 different patterns, 100 different trajectories, 100 different ways of getting to the other end and scoring the basket. I think of it in that way. I try to stay loose about that. There's not much more to say about it than that. But again, that's me. The answers you're hearing are answers from me. They may or may not resemble answers from any other writers, but that's what you do. If your aspiration is to be a writer, your first job is to discover yourself and to find out what you do well and to maximize your own best qualities and to do it your way as well as you can. So these are strictly my answers. They may or may not resemble the answers of anybody else.
Wow, I don't know how much more inspiring you can get, Jerry. So thank you for making everybody else have a very high bar to try and get to. For this year, I really love to keep a very close pulse on what my listeners want and what the community needs as writers. We have this incredible online community we've created because of this podcast. I keep a very close eye on what it is that they want and what it is that they're always asking. So hopefully this will bring them some peace. And these are questions that they're usually asking about within the communities. Many writers in our community who are in the process of querying literary agents, they're petrified and they're not sure what the results are going to be like. If there's any reassuring words that you can share or bestow upon them, please do share, Jerry. I know that it would mean so much to them in their journey.
First thing that comes to mind is very simple. Keep it short. I mean, this is not rocket science. No more than one page. Recalling my conversation with Ellen Adams and what led to The Warden's Daughter, I grew up in prison. I grew up in prison. Five words. I grew up in prison. If you can't be brief and cogent and meaningful in your query letter, then the reader of your query letter is going to assume that you cannot do so in your story as well. So prove that you can be clear and effective and brief and meaningful as a writer right from the start in your query letter. That's your first audition. Keep it clear, keep it brief, keep it to one page. Clearly express what it is that you have said. Put it into just a few words, what you're trying to do and why people will want to read it. And let them take it from there. And listen, the main thing, query letters can get your, they can help to get you started, but they are not going to tell the tale. What's going to tell the tale is your own writing. When we do workshops, you know, we say, well, again, location, 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 structure, 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 write, write, write. Mm-hmm. What you do between you and the keyboard, early in the morning or late at night when nobody else is around and the door is shut behind you, that's what's going to tell the tale, more so than your query letter or the workshops that you attend or the pencil sharpener that you just bought. That's what's going to do it.
That was brilliant. Keep it simple and you're on the way. Thank you for that. Now, the second question, money. Tips on earning income while you're trying to survive as an artist or a writer.
Well, it may depend on how many potatoes you need to put on the table. I had to put 8 potatoes on the table. There were me, my wife, and 6 kids. I didn't have the luxury of sitting back and writing for 15 years stories that nobody wanted. I had to work. So there was no choice. The whole question was moot. So you tailor your life according to your circumstances. And as I said, I wrote in the cracks. And I say this, I've been around people all my life that have said, oh, I want to be a writer. I was telling this to the kids long before Nike said it. Just do it. You just do it. If you want to write, you'll find a way. And so I had a full-time job. I had two part-time jobs, and I found a way to write. Book number 5 that I wrote became the first published book. And then good things began to happen. So if it's your dream, dreams need to be worked on. Just like a fire needs oxygen, you just find the time to do it. In my case, I had been an English major in college, and I got a job with a magazine that catered to department store executives. I was working as an editor for that job. I wasn't crazy about the job. That was okay because it was just a means to an end to put the 8 potatoes on the table. I started living my dream each day at 12 and off to lunch, after dinner and on weekends. As I said before, as an artist in general and a writer in particular, you design your own life. Waiting for you after college or high school, you will find no such thing as a fiction factory. You need to design it yourself, and whatever way works for you is the answer for you. May or may not resemble what anybody else is doing, but that's beside the point. As long as it works for you, that's what you need to do.
That was fantastic. I love that realness that you dished out to the listeners. So now the third rapid fire question is, what are small, manageable steps you would advise writers to take every week towards accomplishing their writing goals?
I would say it's an attitude. You keep doing it. It's an attitude that you don't require a dramatic sunset or fantastic music in the background. You treat it like a job. Don't put unreasonable demands, because what winds up as art begins as grunt work. You just have to treat it as a job that you go to every day, as little as a half an hour after dinner maybe, or after the kids go to bed, or before you go to bed, during your lunch hour. But try to make it a regular, repeatable sanctuary. And you don't ask yourself, do I have writer's block or not? You don't ask yourself, am I inspired? You don't ask yourself, do I really feel like going down into that well again today, right now? You don't think about any of that. You just do it. Just like Nike says, you just do it. And you do it day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, book after book. Once you finish the first book, fine. The biggest sin you can commit, and I'm talking old school here. I'm not talking about self-publication, which has become more widespread now, of course, and which you probably know a lot more about than I do, my generation. Old school-wise, if you're talking about getting published by way of a publishing house in a traditional sort of way, the biggest sin you can commit is to have your manuscript sitting on your coffee table for more than 24 hours. It needs to be out in the mail or in the email or in cyberspace. It needs to, one way or another, hard copy or cyber, it needs to be heading someplace to an agent or a publisher. Meanwhile, while it's off in heading for a publisher, you, then number two, is if you then just sit back and wait for the results. No, you don't sit back and wait for the results. You get on to your next book. And when your next book collects nothing but rejection slips, you get on to the next one. You just keep at it, that's all. Because often it's not so much a matter of who wins the race. This is cool. You discover this. It's not so much a matter, as it turns out, oh my God, he got published. He won the race. In a lot of cases, what it is that person that got published is the only one left in the race because the others have dropped out. That has a lot to do with it. What kept me going for those 15 years, submitting all those manuscripts and never getting an acceptance letter? That's the equivalent of knocking on doors, applying for jobs for 15 years. Imagine graduating from college and going 15 years without getting one job offer. That's what happened to me. I'm certainly not the only writer that has a story like that. You just keep going. You're not getting participation trophies in this world. There are no entitlements, even writer's block. I don't recognize writer's block as a thing. If I'm standing in 2 feet of water here in my basement and I need a plumber and I call the plumber, and the plumber says, oh, I'm sorry, I'm having plumber's block today. I can't come in. You know, teachers don't call in and say to the principal, I can't come in today, I've got teacher's block. You know, we writers are the only ones that give ourselves this luxurious excuse to not have to do the hard work of writing and go off to the movies and have a milkshake because we've got writer's block. Of course, sometimes I don't feel like it. A lot of times I don't feel like it. Sometimes there doesn't seem to be an idea in my head. You give it authority if you recognize it. I just don't recognize it as a real thing. Even if you're just mechanically moving a pen across a paper, get started. Think you'll find if you don't recognize it as a thing, then it's going to disappear and you'll get on your way.
Thank you so much for that. You just shared a Sure. wealth of information that is gold to the community. So thank you, thank you, thank you. And if you have any books that you recommend that are on writing craft tips, please share. And if not, no worries at all.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I'm reaching for it now. I keep it on my desk, and when I'm in the process of writing a book, I use it like a daily devotional, read one page a day. It's made that way. Each page is a different writer's subject. It's called Walking on Alligators by Susan oh. Shaughnessy. I love it. It is just packed with good stuff for writers, and I don't care if you're a beginning writer or an honored veteran. You can do yourself a favor by dipping into a page of this book once a day.
Thank you so much. That was amazing, Jerry.
And that wraps up our episode with the legendary Jerry Spinelli. Jerry, you are so cool, and it was such a treat to talk to you and hear your stories firsthand. Thank you for being such a fun guest to have on our show. Storytellers, I hope you all enjoyed Jerry's episode as much as I loved sharing it with you. I am so grateful for your support, and thank you for hanging out with us every week. Please say hi to Jerry on Twitter at JerrySpinelli1, and that's the number one. Jerry recommended fantastic resources for you to check out, and we have them all linked up on his show notes page over at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Jerry Spinelli. After hearing from many of you about how you wish you had more help in the kitchen so you could spend more time working on your writing, I am so excited that we're collaborating with Sunbasket. I've been trying to eat healthier over the last year, and it gets a bit tough when it comes to finding the time. I know many of you are like me and don't have all the time in the world to plan out our meals, trek to the farmer's market each time, and figure out all the measurements and portions for each ingredient, and that's why you'll love Sunbasket. They deliver delicious, healthy recipes with easy-to-follow directions and pre-measured fresh ingredients straight to your door. And I'm talking about organic, non-GMO ingredients from the best farms and fishermen, and everything is seasonal and sustainably sourced. They have an amazing selection of paleo, gluten-free, vegetarian, breakfast, and new family options created by an award-winning chef and are all nutritionist approved. The recipes are delicious and you'll literally have each meal prepared in about 30 minutes. Go to sunbasket.com/88cups today and get 3 free meals with your first order. That's sunbasket.com/88cups to get 3 healthy, easy to prepare meals. sunbasket.com/88cups. And don't forget to join our Facebook group if you're looking for an intimate community for storytellers where you can check in about your writing and hang out with other storytellers. You can also submit questions for future guests on our show, and we recently added live unboxing and book haul videos. So join me over in our private Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. There's tons of love, support, and encouragement going on in this special community of ours, and I can't wait to meet you in there. Join us at facebook.com/groups/88cups. Have an amazing rest of your week, and I'll catch you in the next episode.
Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.